The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Sonia Usach Kuhn of the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Community Connections. Every month, I will introduce you to people in the community who are making a difference. My guest today is Jerry Dawson, President and CEO of the North Carolina chapter of the ALS Association. Jerry has felt his life's calling was to help people. He has worked in the field of health and human services for more than 20 years, including 5 years in cardiac intensive care units. Between 1988 through 1999, the North Carolina chapter of the ALS Association was operated solely by volunteers without any staff. Jerry became a volunteer in 1999. He was recruited by the national office in March of 2000 as Director of Patient Services. In 2002, he was promoted to President and CEO. His belief system of hard work, surrounding yourself with people who challenge you and have skills that exceed your own, was the approach he took. And today, he feels blessed to be working with an amazing team of dedicated professionals and exceptional volunteers. Jerry was honored with the Rasmussen National Advocate of the Year Award in 2007 for his role in local and federal ALS public policy efforts. In 2007 and 2009, the chapter was recognized as Chapter of the Year. The chapter has received numerous fundraising and innovation awards since then. In 2017, they were recognized for highest earned revenue nationally in their market group for the WALK program, as well as receiving an innovation award for the Duke Telemedicine ALS Program Partnership. And this year, they received an innovation award for the Medical Advisory Council, which encourages continuity of care from the multidisciplinary ALS clinics to healthcare providers in communities throughout North Carolina. Jerry holds a BSN degree from East Carolina University. He enjoys spending time with his wife Becky and daughters Samantha and Savannah and their pups Max and Bella. So glad to have you with us on Community Connections.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Jerry, while ALS is still considered a rare disease, it is quite prevalent not only in our state and country, but throughout the world. There are so many people who don't know what amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, is. Some recognize it by its more familiar name, Lou Gehrig's disease. Please give our listening audience some insight into this devastating disease.
Sure. I think one of the easiest ways to explain it is that it's a motor neuron disease, and so the nerve cells that connect your brain through your spinal cord and out to the muscles in your body, the motor nerves that help you move, they die. And when they die, you lose the ability to move the part of your body that's affected in that by that nerve. And so progressively, and it's different in different people. Some people, it may start in their throat or their swallowing, their speech, slurring of speech, or it may start in their arms or their legs, and they may notice weakness or muscle twitching and things like that. Those are the ways that it kind of presents itself. And the average life expectancy is about 2 to 5 years. And they slowly lose their ability and to function in different ways, to walk, talk, eat, and eventually breathe. So it's an awful disease, and that's why we're around to make life easier and better for the people that have it.
Right. So what about the families?
Well, you know, I mean, with a disease that really, it's as hard as ALS and affects so much of a person's ability to be independent, it affects not just that person, it affects the entire family. So you have to think about the caregivers and the family members that are involved. Many times it's multiple family members that are involved. In some cases, there's only one, or in some cases, not even one. And so many resources are needed to make sure that people have what they need in order to have a good quality of life.
Right. So I'm curious, you became a volunteer. Why, among the many causes you could have become a volunteer with, why did you choose ALS?
I've been asked this question many times, and the answer is baseball, really. I grew up playing baseball, and as a kid, you always have people that you look up to. And one of the people that was kind of a hero of mine was Jim Catfish Hunter, who was a legend from North Carolina, northeastern North Carolina, a little town called Hertford, and amazing pitcher. Everybody just all of my friends anyway, wanted to be like him. And then he was diagnosed with ALS in 1998. And when he became diagnosed, I became interested in it and became a volunteer. And not long after that, the national office talked to me about, you know, getting involved more and possibly working for the association. And that was 19 years ago, and here I am today.
Yeah, some people have a family connection, and some people have this emotional connection that you had with Catfish Hunter.
But I can tell you, since that time, I've lost so many friends to ALS. And even I lost our dog to canine ALS. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that, but it's a thing. It really is. And we built a ramp on our house and everything. Many, many connections, and some since then that are friends, parents. ALS, I think, is more common than a lot of people think.
Right. Sometimes you meet somebody, and for one reason or another, you have to tell them that you know somebody with ALS and say, do you know what it is? Not everybody knows what it is. When you mention Lou Gehrig, then they know. When you mention the ice bucket challenge, then they have this little connection. But it's not strong enough.
Right. Well, that's why I appreciate you having me on today, so that we can help increase that awareness.
Right. So now, Wes, you moved up the ladder with the chapter. How and with whom did you develop your team?
I think if you've ever been involved with a nonprofit organization, you know that you're always going to wear whatever hat needs to be worn at that moment. So we started out very small. It began as a volunteer-led organization. June Thompson founded the chapter in 1987. I became involved around 2000, and we just had a couple of staff, and as we grew and more people found out about us and that we had resources available, we just started networking, and we kept looking for the right talent, people with the right skill set. And we're fortunate in this area to have many very talented individuals that are living here and willing to, you know, help make the world a little bit better place than when they found it.
So the composition of your staff includes social workers?
Yeah. So we have social workers who – we have development people. We say develop fundraisers care services people, and primarily social workers who act as counselors. They offer support groups. They facilitate support groups, and they attend clinics. They're on the phone offering support. We have five multidisciplinary clinics in North Carolina, so they're attending each one of those. Some of them meet weekly, and some meet a couple times a month or once a month, but it's very important, and what they do is incredibly important to the families that are affected by this disease. So,
okay. So, we know that in today's world, there's a lot of medicine that has been developed for various diseases. What is there for ALS, and how does it come about?
So, for ALS, there are four FDA-approved drugs currently, but there are no drugs that stop ALS or arrest ALS. One of them helps with a condition that causes inappropriate emotional reaction. So, like a person may laugh but not mean to laugh, or cry and not mean to cry. And so, but currently there's not really a drug that will stop or significantly slow the disease. There is one drug that was approved a couple years ago, Edaravone or Radicava. They're working, it's an IV infusion, I believe they're working now on an oral pill, you know, that people can take. I think that would be a lot easier for people to use.
Sounds like it would be, because an infusion sounds to me like you have to go to a facility.
Well, there are different ways to do it. You could go to a facility to have it done, or you can do home infusions, but it's a more difficult thing. And so if there were a pill, that would make it easier for folks to use.
To swallow.
Yeah, or maybe they could crush it. I'm not sure. But we'll have to see how that plays out.
Right.
But, you know, when I think about research and treatment and hope, and every day I wake up more hopeful than the day before, and that's just because of all of the resources that have been poured into research since the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge in 2014, which is 5 years ago this summer. There's so much momentum now, and we're learning more and more about ALS, and there are lots of – I could talk for a long time about all the exciting things that are happening, but there are a couple of things that really stand out to me.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the cases are sporadic. That means that anyone can get this disease, and 10% roughly are familial or genetic type of ALS, and we know of over 30 genes connected to the genetic type or contributing to ALS, and five of them have been discovered since the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. And so that's really exciting, because that gives us a target that we can that scientists can then develop drugs, potential treatments to stop ALS. And there are two genes in particular that account for two-thirds of all genetic ALS, and that's the SOD1 gene and the C9ORF72 gene. I know that's – I'm not sure how they name these things. But they have two compounds that are in development. One is entering phase 3 clinical trials right now, and it's what they call an antisense drug. Some people – may have heard it. Heard people talk about designer drugs that target specific areas. Well, that's what this is. These are compounds that target those genes, and they interrupt the replication process. And so when that happens, the hope is that they'll be able to slow down, stop ALS in people that have those genetic mutations. And they've been successful. Early results from one of the studies, the SOD1 study, were very promising. And there's another condition called SMA, and it's spinal muscular atrophy, and it's a disease that affects children. And they developed a drug to treat that. It's a very similar approach, the antisense technology. So it's proven that this approach can work. And so we're just very hopeful for that.
So I'd like to just ask you a little bit about clinical trials. A lot of people here are angry with pharmaceutical companies because pills cost a lot of money. But I have a suspicion that when you do a clinical trial, it involves a lot of money and time and trial and error. And people have to be informed about what could happen to them when they're on a clinical trial. Can you expand that idea a little bit?
Oh, boy, we could talk for hours on this subject alone. I mean, it's so hard. You know, if you have a terminal illness and you want access to a drug now that hasn't made its way through the clinical trial process fully. And drugs can be expensive. So I think I've seen estimates of $1 billion, $2 billion to develop one drug from beginning to market. So it's very expensive, and that's part of what we do as the ALS Association. We want to help drug companies get their compound through testing efficiently as possible. So we worked with the FDA to provide guidance there. And the other thing is early science is so critically important. Getting young people or whatever age people, smart people involved and interested in ALS research, learning more, building on the body of knowledge that we already have so that we learn more about the disease and what's causing it and how we can attack it effectively, because that's the risky science. It costs a lot of money to do that science, and pharmaceutical companies many times won't invest in that early stage research, and they become investors when it looks more promising later. So we fund that early science, a light bulb goes off and we learn something new, and that can attract other sources of funding. So we leverage our dollars even more. That's a big part of what we do. In fact, I don't know if you know about this, but Dr. Berryman is a scientist at NC State University, and he has ALS. And so he's also studying ALS in his lab. And so we're funding him, our chapter, along in partnership with the National ALS Association. We're funding one of his projects, which is to identify biomarkers. And biomarkers are anything you can measure in the blood or maybe the cerebral spinal fluid to tell if someone possibly has ALS. So it could be used as a diagnostic tool, but he's also working to on the same technology to assess whether or not a drug may be reaching its target. So a prognostic tool. That's a huge deal because people progress at different rates. And so if you're in a clinical trial and you progress at one rate and another person progresses at a completely different rate, mm-hmm. and you're both taking, this medication or this drug, how do you know if it's your progression that's working
or
the drug?
Right.
So if you knew that drug was reaching its intended target, that would be a real game changer.
So on the news recently, the architect of the African Museum in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. passed away of ALS. And we do have a baseball player here in Chapel Hill who has ALS. And we did lose a couple of professors at State and Duke.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter who you are, what you do, how old you are.
That's a great point. It's an excellent point. There are some things that we do know are risk factors. If you served in the military, you're about twice as likely to develop ALS. And we're not sure why that is yet. And hopefully that will be something that we will figure out. But you're right. I mean, ALS does not discriminate. It's slightly more prevalent in men than women. But for the most part, it affects just about anyone. Mainly people in their 50s, 60s. But I've seen a few people in their teens. It's rare, thank God. But wow. But it does happen.
Yeah. That's young. Well, I would like to mention Mass General. I understand that they're very gung-ho, and they have young people who are interested in helping to find the cure. Do you know anything about Mass General Hospital?
Well, I know they're very active in ALS space. And the thing about the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge and some of the things that we have a program called the Milton Stefanowicz Postdoctoral Fellowship, and I hope I got that right. It's close, at least. But it's a program designed to fund young people coming out of school so that they can become if they're interested in ALS, they can we can fund their research. And we found that oftentimes they continue in their career to be involved in ALS research and continue to study. They'll build their lab. We help them get that started. And so it's a very important program through the ALS Association. But, you know, collaboration is key. Multidisciplinary clinics are key. And
why don't you talk about them? And how many do we have in North Carolina?
Well, currently we have five.
They're located where?
One is the Jim Catfish Hunter ALS Clinic in Greenville, North Carolina at Vidant. We have one at Duke, and not only do they have the multidisciplinary clinic there, they also have a telemedicine clinic, which we fund as well. And that's very important because as the disease progresses and you lose your ability to move, we can use technology to connect with people wherever they are, as long as they have a secure internet connection and a device to connect with the doctor. Dr. Bedlack in this case. And then we have one at UNC. There's another one at Wake Forest Baptist in Winston-Salem and in Charlotte, North Carolina at Atrium. And we're working on two others. We would like to add one in Wilmington and another one in the mountains. Our goal and our strategic plan is to have an ALS clinic within, I believe it's 90 minutes of 80% of all people living with ALS in North Carolina. And we're very fortunate in this state and with the people that support our chapter to have the resources to support those clinics.
So, support, very mm-hmm. important, right? Mm-hmm. Fundraising becomes an essential component in the fight to cure ALS. So tell us about some of the most important fundraising things that you do.
Yeah, well, it's all important, and any way you can help. I mean, everyone, I think, has the ability to help in some way, whether it's participating in a fundraiser or volunteering your time, you know, to make the world a little bit better place than you found it. But with us, we encourage people to get involved with our walks. We have walks throughout North Carolina and all the areas that I just mentioned where we have clinics. And that the walks alone represent about half of our operating revenue. So without them, the multidisciplinary clinics, it would be hard for us to provide the level of support that we do. Other things people do, they have fundraisers. They make them up. Some people do soccer shootouts and, you know, archery events. There's golf tournaments and all kinds of creative ways that people, you know, take what their interests are and use that to make a difference. And then another way that you can make a difference is to remember the ALS Association North Carolina chapter in your estate planning. So, you know, everyone should have a will. Every single person should have a will. And so if it's important to you, then you can leave a portion of your estate in your will. There are other tax advantage ways of giving too. Some people have to take required minimum monthly distributions from their IRA. And if they want to do that, that can make a huge difference, and it's a tax savings to them.
So before we run out of time in this fascinating conversation we're having, tell us now a little bit about the five-year anniversary of the Ice Bucket Challenge, how folks can come become involved in it.
Yeah. So 5 years ago, this amazing phenomenon happened, and it just went viral. I'm sure if you were alive at that time, you remember it taking over your news feed, and everyone was doing it. Jimmy Fallon, I mean, you name the celebrity, they were doing it, and everyone's neighbor was doing it. So there's a good chance that you did it, too. So in Facebook, these videos will start popping up this summer in your history, and it'll say 5 years ago, remember when you did this thing? Well, now you know it made this huge difference. I mean, it was not for naught. It made a big difference. And what you can do, you could just reshare that video again, challenge three more people to do it, make a donation at alsnc.org, and ask other people to do it, because we're not finished yet, and people need help. And we need to make sure we get this job done, and you can help us do that.
How can people get in touch with you and your staff?
I'll just go online to alsnc.org, or you can call. The toll-free number is 877-568-4347. And, you know, we're here to help everyone. So,
Jerry Dawson, thank you so much for being with us on Community Connections.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
Thank you for spending this last half hour with me and Community Connections. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments, questions, or would like to be a sponsor of Community and Connections, please call 919-832-5138. I'm Sonia Usach-Kuhn. See you next time on the radio.